Imagine, if you will, that the most frightening things on Earth are about to come out of the darkness. They will look surprisingly like your neighbors, your friends, your family.
This situation must be controlled before it's too late. They are multiplying too rapidly.
Now accept the fact that there's no escaping the awful consequences.
We've got to survive. Somebody's got to survive.
When there is no more room in hell, the dead will walk the earth. Dawn of the Dead.
They must be destroyed on sight.
There is nothing you can do to stop it. It's too late. It's already happening at a theater near you. Dawn of the Dead contains scenes of violence that may be considered shocking. No one under 17 will be admitted. Dawn of the Dead from United Film Distributing Company.
Leaving Charlie to continue gathering reports over the phone, Fran snatches up the sheets and moves across the room. She stops at the consoles. Fran.
I'm going to knock off the old rescue stations. I'll have the new ones ready as soon as I can.
Technician.
We're sending people to places that have closed down. I'm going to kill the old list.
Fran moves towards another control room. An armed officer stops her. A young man, rushing through copy, intercedes. Man.
Hey, she's all right.
Officer.
Where's your badge?
Fran reaches instinctively for the lapel on her blouse. Her badge is missing. Fran.
Jesus.
Man.
She's all right.
Fran.
I had it. I was asleep over there.
She makes a move toward the corner where she was asleep. Man.
Somebody stole it. There's a lot of them missing.
Two, officer.
She's all right. Let her through.
The officer reluctantly steps aside. The young man and Fran move down a crowded hall and into a small camera room. The foot traffic is solid. They walk as they talk. Fran.
I don't believe it.
Man.
One of those little badges can open a lot of doors. You avoid a lot of hassles if you got a badge. Any kind of badge.
Fran.
It's really going crazy.
They reach a small camera installation. The camera is aimed at a machine, which rolls out a list of rescue stations. The list is superimposed over the live broadcast as it goes out. Cameraman.
You got new ones?
Fran.
I gotta type them up.
Kill those old ones.
Cameraman.
Gibbons wants them.
Fran.
Kill him, Dick. Tell Gibbons to see me.
The man clicks off his camera. Fran moves toward the studio. On the monitors, we see the rescue stations blink off over shots of the two men who still argue on the air. TV Man 1.
Well, I don't believe in ghosts, Doctor.
TV Man 2.
These are not ghosts, nor are these humans. These are dead corpses. Any unburied human corpse with its brain intact will, in fact, reactivate. And it's precisely because of incitement by irresponsible public figures like yourself that this situation is being dealt with irresponsibly by the public at large.
Another outraged cry goes up from the stagehands and observers. Dr. Foster tries to outscream the cries. TV Man 2.
You have not listened. You have not listened to the situation for 3 weeks.
Fran moves into the large studio area where the broadcasters argue. The commotion is maddening. Fran stares for a moment. TV Man 2, now distraught, almost pleading.
This situation is controllable. People must come to grips with this concept. It's extremely difficult with friends, with family. But a dead body must be deactivated by either destroying the brain or severing the brain from the rest of the body.
Another outburst in the studio. TV Man 2.
This situation must be controlled before it's too late. They are multiplying too rapidly.
Fran moves through the crowded room of emotional people and finally reaches another emergency radio installation. Skip and Dusty are trying to listen to their receivers. They jot notes. Fran.
Operative rescue stations.
Dusty.
They're dropping like flies. Here's a few. You know, I think Foster's right. I think we're losing the war.
Fran.
Yeah, but not to the enemy. We're blowing it ourselves.
She gives the rest of her coffee to the two men. Fran.
Not much left, but half a ball.
The two men each slug eagerly from the paper cup. Fran rushes off towards a large teleprompter typing machine. The broadcasters still argue emotionally. TV Man 1.
People aren't willing to accept your solutions, Doctor, and I, for one, don't blame them.
TV Man 2.
Every dead body that is not exterminated becomes one of them. It gets up and kills. The people it kills get up and kill.
Handing the list of active rescue stations to the teleprompter typist, Fran rushes back toward the control room. The previous material was excerpted from the 1977 working draft for the motion picture Dawn of the Dead by George A. Romero. Sound clips from the film itself, and elements from the novelization by Susanna Sparrow, as read by Jonathan Davis for the audiobook. Thanks to the lengthy explorations of the Romeros and the title music in our previous episode, I need to reach back to take a closer look at elements of Minute 2 before progressing to Minute 3.
Ready, get the new list of rescue stations. Charlie's received.
receiving on the emergency?
Rescue station.
Half of those are inoperative as of now.
Charlie, these are rescue stations. We can't send people to inoperative rescue stations.
We've had old information on the air for the last 12 hours.
When Fran was sent for updates on rescue stations, in the street play she found Charlie on the phone with New Hope, a town about 45 minutes northeast of Philly. Despite being filmed in Pittsburgh, the movie is initially set in Philadelphia, 5 hours east. In the Argento cut, Charlie gets in an extra couple of lines.
Doing what I can. These are definite as of now.
In the script, there's reference to Skip and Dusty, also manning radios, presumably like Charlie, receiving updates on the emergencies. More on that later. Charlie is a balding middle-aged man, played by Vic Clemon in his only screen appearance. IMDb credits Clemon as Charlie Parker, WGON TV typist. I'm not sure what source was used for that credit. You may remember that despite being divorced, Francine Parker still uses the married name from her ex, Charles Parker III. Now, in Susanna Sparrow's novelization of Dawn of the Dead, and in the original script, Clemon's character is only referred to as Charlie. One might speculate that Charlie was either Fran's ex-husband, or more likely, the ex-father-in-law who helped her get her job at WGON. That might explain why Fran was okay with him, quoting the novel, having patted her on the backside as she gathered up the sheets from his messy desk. Even in the 70s, it would have been overly familiar to pat Franny on the fanny if this was just a random coworker. Yes, it's a leap prefaced on a probably erroneous internet listing, but it's your optional headcanon to take or leave as you please. Vet Kleeman died in 2016 and was an internationally recognized roller coaster enthusiast. Here's a clip from Pittsburgh's WTAE Action News 4 about the celebration of his 80th birthday on his favorite coaster, the Jackrabbit at Kennywood Park.
A lot of people love roller coasters at Kennywood, but one man simply loves the Jackrabbit most of all. Vic Clayman is from Pittsburgh's Knoxville neighborhood. He rode the roller coaster 90 times on Sunday, over and over again. That brings his grand total to, get this, 4,000 trips on the Jackrabbit.
I feel great. I don't know if I could go to another 90, but I bet you I could go another 50.
With all that riding, 90 times yesterday, Vic looks really great. He's 78 years old. He's a member of the American Coaster Enthusiast Society. By the way, Jackrabbit celebrates its 90th anniversary at Kennywood this season.
On the Jackrabbit's 95th birthday, Clemens celebrated by riding it 95 consecutive times, along with other members of the American Coaster Enthusiasts. Kennywood's YouTube page offered video surrounding the occasion.
If you don't know Vic, you may have seen him in the newspaper, the television station in New Zealand, all over the media, all over the world, for what he has done for riding 5,000 rides on the Jackrabbit, which he finished up on the celebration of the 95th birthday of Jackrabbit by taking 95 ride marathon. So his 95th ride on a single day in late May was also his 5,000th lifetime ride. We don't do this very often. I think we've only done it maybe once prior to this. But every once in a while, the occasion and the person arises that we need to recognize, and it just so happens that this time around, it's going to be you, Vic. Woo! I will leave with this proclamation of this. In recognition of your outstanding loyalty, support, endearing patronage to Kennywood Park, we are very proud to present you with, Mr. Vic Clemon, a Kennywood Lifetime Pass. Yeah!
He loved Kennywood's Jackrabbit more than anyone. Word tonight of the passing of Victor Clayman. Last May, we were there as Clayman rode the Jackrabbit for the 5,000th time. He rode the coaster 95 times in a row to celebrate its 95th birthday. He'd been a visitor at the park every year since he moved to the area back in 1959. Clayman passed away at his home yesterday. He was 83 years old.
Vic Clayman was born on a farm in Covington, Kentucky on August 28, 1932. When he was 8 years old, he snuck onto the Wildcat at Coney Island near Cincinnati, Ohio. And it was there he got bit by the coaster bug. In 1959, after the death of his father, he and his mother moved to the Knoxville section of Pittsburgh, where they discovered Kennywood Park. And he has been riding ever since. For many years, he was the general manager of a wholesale grocery firm until he retired about 25 years ago. He visited this park over 30 times a year every summer. And although he told everyone his favorite roller coaster was the one he was riding at the moment, I think we know that he has a very endearing affection for the Jackrabbit. But there is more to Vic than just roller coasters. He was a well-known stage actor, director, and producer in community theater in the greater Pittsburgh area. He received a degree in theater from the University of Cincinnati in 1959, and he certainly put it to good use. It is said that his favorite role was Daddy Warbucks in Annie. He also played Soodalus in A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, George in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, and the King in The King and I. His last role was the gatekeeper at the Kennyville Cemetery here during Phantom Fright Nights. Vic had a good-natured attitude. He was kind and friendly. And it is said, once he was your friend, he was your friend. So today we pause to remember Vic Fleeman. I ask each of you to remember how Vic may have touched or influenced your life.
According to a 2016 blog post by Dan Hauer for CoasterNation.com, Fleeman had been battling bladder cancer and congestive heart failure. He was survived by his partner of 32 years, Jim, and a rainbow was reported over Kennywood a few hours after his passing. At the three-minute mark of the extended cut that guides this podcast, we return to the control room. There's a group of men arguing inaudibly in the back area where people would constantly be gathered throughout the sequence of the film. The man who is sleeping in a chair near Fran at the beginning of the film is seated elsewhere and talking to another unidentified man with a flannel shirt, glasses, and a beard. A pudgy, mustachioed fellow, later to be named Dan, back more on that later, pounds on some pages beside him. Tony, as played by Cliff Forrest, props up the back wall, drinking coffee with a paper cup. The character played by Michael Lies has a discussion with another lean fellow sporting a beard, but wearing glasses. Any help from the audience on IDing these actors would be greatly appreciated. A small, bespectacled elderly woman can briefly be seen in the background. Barbara Lifshire is credited for set decoration, along with costume designer Josie Caruso, but we'll address her during her on-screen appearance later. Sets were by Production Coordinators, another generic company name I can't do anything with 4 decades on. Michelle Martin only has one other costume and wardrobe department credit for Mario Gariazzo's 1988 Italian flick Fratello dello Spazio, translated as The Brother from Space, ironically without relation to the John Sayles feature. I also can't establish any relationship to the Canadian scholar and author of the same name. Surprise, Joseph Eberle only has the one graphics credit on IMDb. Not sure there's any connection to the 1950s pulp sci-fi illustrator. While it was somewhat referenced through Flyboy's difficulty entering the station in a minute or two, the theft of Fran's access badge and its value were dropped from the finished film. While in the script it was two men vouching for Fran with the cop, a copy boy and an unnamed reporter, in the novelization they are folded into Tony, the fellow who woke Fran up at the beginning of the movie. Speaking of, Tony's instead in the control booth with the other keyed-up men in the finished film. There's also an argument with a smarmy technician about killing the Chiron in the novelization.
Givens wants him on, said the gruff technician with the big beer belly and graying hair. Fran always had trouble with this one. He resented a pretty young thing giving him orders. She had spoken with Mr. Givens before about this man's chauvinistic attitude. Apparently, he had ignored any warning, if there had been one. But now was not the time to raise his consciousness.
I think the movie does a good job of showing the news station as bustling and crowded, but the script indicates Romero wanted even more bodies than he had available. The room Fran slept in was meant to be filled with sleepers, and now she walked down a hallway meant to be packed like a subway at rush hour. She was supposed to be seeing a cameraman about disabling the Chiron, which created a redundancy of two scenes where one would suffice. Therefore, we only have Dick defending Givens' orders in the film, and he isn't a redhead as described in the book. Despite being named and having lines, Dick's goateed and respectable brown-haired actor isn't credited. Since the name is in the screenplay, and the only person in the production credits named Dick was busy being a touring bassist in rock bands, that seems like a reach. Once again, it's noted in the book that Fran has to step up and be the tough lady boss, or else these guys would try to get away with murder. There's a darker-skinned man working at a console behind Dick, perhaps Latino or East Indian, but he's out of focus. An attractive blonde woman sits cross-legged on the side of the console, pursuing notes. Actress Liz Augenstein is listening to the show through earphones deepest in the background. Fran exits the control room to look out from a Spartan stairway leading down to the studio. It's a far cry from the rows of empty studio audience chairs described in the novelization.
Fran walked down the center aisle and found an empty seat at the end of the fifth row from the stage. She practically collapsed into the seat, feeling for the first time how physically weak she really was. The doctor had told her she would start to feel tired, but she hadn't given it much thought in the past few days. The only reminder she had was her constant nausea.
There's an overhead shot of the studio floor, where guest Dr. Foster and host Sydney Berman continue their argument. A single large WGON circular logo is easily visible on one camera. Another has stenciled call letters on a piece of paper taped to the side. I never noticed the extremely lo-fi branding until it was pointed out to me on a podcast, and now I can't help but see the crude artifice. Explosive effects are credited to Gary Zeller and Don Barry. Zeller worked heavily in the early 80s on projects like Scanners, Visiting Hours, The Last Dragon, and Amityville 2, The Possession. Zeller International specializes in non-toxic environmental chemistry, often for live theater and the movie industry. Their super stretchy clear text material was used to make webs for the cinematic Spider-Man. A picture of Gary Zeller with Jim Belushi on the set of the dark comedy Neighbors can be found online. And in recent years, Zeller sold one of the M16s seen in Dawn. Zeller also received the Academy Award for Scientific Achievement for inventing Zell Gel Stunt Gel, which improved the safety of firework in film. In the book Memories of the Dead, Zombies Tell All, stuntman actor Tasso Savrakis once recalled that after one long night, he was finishing up zombies in the community room before traveling down a long, narrow hallway to check at the mall. Halfway through, Tom and Gary Zeller came hurtling down the hall driving a golf cart at high speed. Tasso's first instinct was to hug the wall to let them pass, until he realized they had intentionally targeted him. Describing the Zellers, he called them douchebags who were red-eyed and giggling like drunken schoolgirls, ricocheting off the walls. Tasso failed to outrun them, and so turned back to confront. He instinctively lifted his foot to catch the hood and leapt. The impact knocked me straight up, somersaulting over the cart, one of my best stunts of the movie and nobody ever saw it. Finally, he noted that, inexplicably for everyone else, he'd left a black boot print on the wall and ceiling, far higher than anyone else would have been able to reach barring getting run over by a golf cart. Don Barry worked on a few of the same movies as Zeller, but also acted in minor parts for Knight Riders and Martin Scorsese's Bringing Out the Dead. You'll recall Scorsese and Romero also timeshared a print of Tales of Hoffman back in the day. Weapons were supplied by the Plastics Factory. Weapons coordinator was Clayton Hill, who will play a featured zombie later. Original soundtrack was by The Goblins with Dario Argento. We'll surely return to them as well. Still photography was by Catherine Colbert, as she would later do for Creepshow and 17 episodes of Tales from the Dark Side. Colbert's image and work also turned up in the documentaries Document of the Dead and The Dead Will Walk. She will turn up much later as a member of the biker gang. For you Justice League Europe fans out there, this Catherine Colbert spells both names with a K rather than a C. Final credit of the minute is continuity by John Rice, who will also play one of the key SWAT officers coming up soon in the film. The novelization notes that Fran sees Dr. Foster and Sydney Berman arguing like puppets on the stage. Her sympathies are clearly with the plaintive logic of the former over the populism of the latter. When she's had enough of them, she moves on to Skip and Dusty, described as young men manning the phones for updates. Further elaborating, Dusty was meant to look more like a cowboy off the range than a TV reporter. Clearly, Dusty and Skip were dropped from the movie. When Christine Forrest's TV producer character leaves her desk, she angrily calls on a fellow named Dan to replace her. Dan had been in the control booth throughout the sequence, mostly arguing in the background. Now he took on Dusty's lines, and given the name change, I have to wonder if the actor was one of the six Dans credited on the IMDb page. Or rather, that was my theory. As I was editing this episode, listening to the same minutes of audio again and again, I finally realized that Christine Forrest's character is actually a tattletale. She's yelling out to and storming off in search of station manager Dan Givens. So I guess I'm back to looking for the actor who played Dusty?
They vow to stay together forever, that their love would never die. But their pledge remain untested.
Oh, cool.
No problem. I'm the boss's son, remember?
Until they went looking for a thrill. And stumbled on the chilling fact.
Let's proceed.
That even the dead can go on living.
It came back to life.
We gotta get out of here.
And tonight, fate will put their promises to the test. Now that she's dead, he's frightened to live without her. But bringing her back is terrifying.
Oh, God, Kurt, that was incredible. Let's do it again.
Contain it, damn it! Seal it off now!
Is that what I'm gonna become?
These poor dead bastards crave brains.
She bit me. She gave you something bad.
I feel so hungry.
I'll never find you down here.
What have you done?
If she attacks him, he becomes like her.
I just get a little confused.
love never dies.
Brian Yuzna directed The Overrated Society, and not much else you'd want on your IMDb page. He specializes in horror movies that look like ambitious but underfunded stage plays with bad lighting, including those straight-to-video jobs that trailer ahead of movies you suddenly realize from their presence you shouldn't have rented. It takes a special kind of ineptitude to release a $2 million sequel to a classic horror comedy as a melodrama that only recoups a quarter of its budget. Still, if only because of late-night showings in my formative years, I have a very small amount of affection for Return of the Living Dead Part 3. It isn't in any way objectively good, but it is surprisingly watchable and has memorable moments. Following the credits, the movie opens on the set of a Wilson Phillips video. No wait, that's just the overpowering presence of the early 90s at work. Acid wash jeans, floppy boy hair, those stupid hats. If such a movie were produced today, I would howl over how insanely on the nose of 1992 everything was. Might as well be a very special Stranger Things. Anyway, this is the story of an army brat boy falling in love with a bad girl to the dismay of his widowed daddy. Pops is involved in a very loose continuation of the previous movies, including Night of the Living Dead. His idea was to have the military use zombies as weapons against enemy nations, but that soon fell out of favor. It was replaced by a project involving zombies acting as meat batteries for exoskeletons controlled through medieval means. Half of what I just said made no sense, but there's enough idiocy in the script that focusing on any one entity requires an impressive amount of tunnel vision on the viewer's part. The script is wretched, the characters are all deserving of dire fates, and Pitfall Harry couldn't get over all the potholes. The boy sneaks onto a military installation that must be run by Gomer Pyle to show his girlfriend the reanimated dead, until whoops, she joins their ranks. Forgetting all that stuff from the first movie about zombies needing to eat brains to relieve themselves temporarily of the agony of being undead, the bad girl instead uses pain to distract herself from wanting to eat whatever human body part is readily available, specifically her boyfriend's. On the run through South Central Los Angeles, the star-crossed couple trip into all sorts of offensive racial caricatures. Spotlighted is a magical Negro derelict who shelters the couple in his sewer home while growling every moronic line. He's still better than the boy. An actor so bad I'm not sure I buy his respirations, much less recitations. The girl actually went on to better things, but she's still finding her way here. Just so I'm not accused of minimizing the star actress, Melinda Clark eventually made her mark on television through long-term roles on The O.C. and Nikita. As a softcore fan, I knew her from Return to Two Moon Junction. And as a comic geek, she's Jessica Priest, the killer of Al Simmons in the to-date only movie adaptation of Todd McFarlane's Spawn. Her forte is femme fatales with piercing cat eyes, and she's lovely enough to rate a viewing of the movie for the view. While I'm mentioning notable actresses, Ursa herself, Sarah Douglas, also has a small adversarial role that she's too good for. Prior to the hour mark, things really start to drag. But the film seems to reach its anticlimax within a quarter past. Disconcertingly, the movie then continues for another quarter hour, which feels inorganic, but is actually where most of the money and fucked up imagery end up. What makes it weird is that it's 9/10 of a vampire movie, then suddenly becomes a true zombie flick about the time you're ready to check out. In summary, the movie is a mess. Everything looks cheap, the script sucks, the acting bites, fans of the early movies will miss the yucks, and zombie fans will largely miss the yuck. Still, our heroine zombie serves as an early alternative culture-piercing cutting proto-icon. There are some clever bits, and it's generally better than the sum of its parts. On to the special features. Remember what I said about trailers earlier? This disc is all using the features, including Progeny, Faust, Love of the Damned, and The Dentist 1 and 2. Film geeks usually appreciate a director's commentary that goes into the level of detail found on the DVD, unless it's a Brian Yuzna production. So wait, he just kept repainting the same boxes and shining different colored lights through them to give the appearance of new set locations? Who'd have thunk it? Besides everyone. Then holy shit, there's a cast commentary? Fuck! Someone's getting fired over this waste of company resources. Also, I don't know if you can technically call it a cast when one member and a technician show up. At least it was Melinda Clark, the only one you'd want to hear from, joined by second unit effects supervisor Tom C. Rainone. Such fun to listen to the awkward silences whenever Tom hits on the actress or steers the conversation toward right-wing politics. This would have been adequate on its own, but after a second viewing with the director, enough was enough. Recently, my buddy Mac forwarded me a tweet where someone pointed out the similarities between the government's response to COVID-19 and the opening sequence of Dawn. It reminded me of a video posted by Consequence of Sound in 2018, titled "The Scariest Scene in Dawn of the Dead Doesn't Have a Single Zombie." Here's an excerpt, though I urge you to watch the full video. It's insightful, although they do fail to notice that the time span between Night of the Living Dead and Dawn is explicitly stated as 3 weeks by Dr. Foster, which you may have heard earlier this episode.
All throughout the studio, the staff tries desperately to make sense of the dire situation. "I'm still dreaming," her coworker eerily tries to convince herself. And by this point, it's clear that the emergency broadcast system is not only useless, but actually quite dangerous. leaving audiences to shake, rattle, and wonder, what if our systems failed us? How long would we survive? Could we even hope to survive? The opening sequence is arguably the most terrifying in the film, if only because it feels real. There's no slapstick comic relief outside of a PA giving a scientist bunny ears, and it doesn't feature any gruesome special effects work by Tom Savini. This isn't Walter Cronkite putting Americans at ease after the news of President Kennedy's murder flashed across his desk. This is a crew of men and women who are terrified and confused, and can't hide behind any traditional stoicism. In other words, the newsroom and the world is up for grabs. Romero directs the chaos not unlike the way Spielberg directs a bustling family at dinnertime, with each cut, each conversation, and each pile of papers thrown in exasperation, expertly escalating the tension. Not one zombie is featured on screen. Instead, Romero allows the paranoia and fear of the newsroom staff to display an unnerving sense of dread.
People on the television not really answering the question, but making it more confusing. That's conscious. That's been the conscious part of that. Because that's generally what it's about, you know. Ladies and gentlemen, there was just a plane crash. It took out a small piece of Manhattan. Well, more later. You know, it's never reassuring or, you know, it's always alarming.
Romero, seen in a cameo, working the boards just like his salad days on Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, cuts to the broadcast stage, with David Hurley's Mr. Berman arguing with David Crawford's Dr. Foster about the emergency situation at hand. It's a facts versus feelings debate that could very well appear on any number of political talk shows. Yeah, they're fighting over how to handle a zombie plague, but it might as well be Sean Hannity arguing with Bill Nye over climate change. At this moment, Romero expertly blends visceral horror imagery in the vein of The Exorcist and Texas Chainsaw Massacre with the breakneck newsroom drama of Network and All the President's Men, both touchstones of the era. It's a rare thing for audiences to get to see how the world deals with a zombie plague right here at the beginning, even in a post-Romero world of films aping his concepts and social satire.
It's been nearly 8 months since the last episode of ZombieCast, and I have excuses, though not necessarily enduring ones. For starters, I spent 4 weeks of that time on vacation in three countries, plus I attended three comic conventions in as many states. After gathering recordings of dozens of participants over about a half a decade, I finally edited together the 5 1/4-hour-long 100th episode of the Marvel Superheroes podcast. For even longer, I was developing a show devoted to the official handbook of the Marvel Universe. That's currently 7 episodes in, with even more recordings and guests to juggle on an ambitious twice-monthly schedule. We also launched a podcast devoted to the TV show Buck Rogers in the 25th Century, but that's a minimal effort affair that's more break than burden. Because of all these events, several shows dear to my heart took lengthy hiatuses, but it was especially painful regarding ZombieCast. The Movies by Minutes format comes with expectations of a very steady release schedule, so listeners don't lose the thread of the film being discussed. I did warn you that I'm not an adherent to those expectations going in, and I do think there's enough extras in each episode of ZombieCast to stand up as a single serving of entertainment divorced from a larger whole. Still, I wish I'd stuck to the original plan of banking a few episodes ahead of release. But as I rediscovered with this episode, I can't produce this show at 50%. It was almost certainly a mistake to do a double-length tribute to George and Chris Romero made up of hours and hours of found footage audio strung together with only the second episode. But I couldn't stop once I'd started. Every episode means researching some unfamiliar face from the Pittsburgh theater scene in the late 70s, poring over local news archives, and building a database of leads that will hopefully help me in the future. It's watching 3 edits of the movie multiple times each for the original and commentary audio, so far from the beginning of the movie each time, and for a few minutes beyond the minute being covered in the episode. Then trying to cross-reference that with material from the screenplay, documentaries, and related books I have on hand, including the novelization and Audacity adaptation of same. I thought I'd work on this episode for a few hours on Saturday before moving on to something else. Instead, I basically did nothing else all weekend but eat and sleep without finishing. I'm not complaining, mind. I'm confessing how obsessive-compulsive and gross myself this movie becomes. Not only is this one of the very few movies that could withstand such scrutiny, but the investigation actually drives me on joyfully. While I was already getting serious about returning to ZombieCast a few weeks ago, it seems like the coronavirus pandemic has pushed me forward. A lot of apocalyptic material is being discussed these days, but specifically the chaotic first 6 minutes of Dawn seems to echo a lot of the fatally incompetent government response. This sort of thing is on everyone's minds. But I'm not pushing the show back out to exploit the interest. The truth is, I don't know how bad this is going to get, and I'm afraid of how the show might be regarded in the context of post-COVID-19 ravages. In short, I don't want to lose the opportunity to do the show because of associations people might make with this goddamn debacle in a few weeks. and I'm trying to hurry up and get to the fucking zombies, just in case. I'm reasonably confident there won't be corona zombies, but I'm terribly afraid there may be other tragedies forthcoming that I don't want the show to conjure up. We need a new list of rescue stations. Who has the new list? Okay, here we go. We have Adriano, After Forever, June 3rd through 5th, 1989 graphic novel. Ann Labs, Chris Thompson, Dr. Lex Draco, Romero Romero, Frank Branches, Geek Nerd Podcasts, The Geekly and More, Grave Girls Podcast, who have a Taylor Swift Zombie Girl GIF available, History of Comics on Film, Hoppy Pods, Illegal Machine, Into the Weird, Iowa's Joe Crawford, Just in Time with the JNT Baggers, Keith G. Baker, Killer Kitch, King Dinosaur, The List Game, Mark James, Marky Shadows, The Mess Hall Podcast, Michael Robert, Mike Rokitansky. Wait, we're receiving an update from Mike. He's letting us know that he's listening to ZombieCast with Diablo Frank. Safe to say I want to hear much more, though I'm just getting to where he addresses Fulci's Zombie 2, and I hope it comes out okay. What, it's one of my top 5 favorite zombie movies. Again, this is a labor of love, so take the time that you need, but I love these deeper dives into the 1978 DOTD, which is for sure a top-tier film, even period for me. And I don't begrudge your feelings for Zombie 2, just love it regardless. I'm also hearing from Odell Abner Dracula, who says that he enjoys all zombie cast material. Okay, we've got additional stations, Pedro Cabazuelo, the Quipster Film Review Podcast, Randy Caldwell, this just in from Randy. Meanwhile, I am watching another episode of iZombie. Okay, Richard G., Richard Van Ingram, Ryan Daly is Socially Distant, Schlocktopus, he's offered a GIF of Freddy offering Jason fashion advice, Shanana Banana, Talk Nerdy to Me, Tim Mason, Trailer Junkies Podcast, and finally, We Could Survive That. Let's all hope.